Hello, welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Every week I read from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is ew.com, and I have quite a mix of stories this week. Last week there were some big articles, and this week I've got a multiple list of articles to read from. So let's get started with our must list. Marvel's delightful Thunderbolts Asterisk, a Netflix true crime series, and The Rehearsal topped this week's must list. Isabel Allende's new novel, My Name is Emilia de Valle, and the latest from fantasy author Joe Abercrombie, The Devils, round out our list of recommendations for the weekend. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. I don't think any of us could have blamed Lindsay Lohan if she chose to disappear from the spotlight and live a quiet family life in Dubai with her husband and son. But man, am I glad we're living in the Lohanissance. Case in point, our latest cover story celebrating her upcoming reunion with Jamie Lee Curtis in the Freaky Friday sequel, Freakier Friday. True Hollywood co-star friendships are rare, especially ones that last 22 years. But there's something about the genuine bond between Lohan and Curtis that has me rooting for them and the movie. That was Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief. The first item on our must list is Thunderbolts Asterisk. Yes, there's an asterisk at the end of the name. Expect the unexpected in Marvel's latest outing, which is just as funny and action-packed as it is dark and profound. The movie assembles antiheroes Yelena and Black Widow, Florence Pugh, Alexei, who plays Red Guardian, David Harbour, Bucky Barnes, who is Winter Soldier, Sebastian Stan, John Walker as U.S. Agent, that's played by Wyatt Russell, and Ava Starr, who's also Ghost, played by Hannah Giancamin. All with ties to Julia Louis-Dreyfus's nefarious CIA head, Valentina Allegra de Fontaine. The misfit B-team must face their demons after encountering a man simply named Bob, played by Lewis Pullman, who discovers he's not so simple after all. And yes, that asterisk will be explained. In TV, we have The Rehearsal. Nathan Fielder's practice makes perfect in this HBO docu-comedy's second season, with the host now on a mission to improve airline safety. Once again, that means going to absurd lengths in the quest to facilitate banter between pilots, even if some of those attempts hilariously crash and burn. My Name is Emilia de Valle. Celebrated author Isabel Allende returns to the Del Valle family with the story of Emilia, a journalist covering a civil war in Chile who is plunged into danger and the turmoil of first love in this riveting 19th century coming-of-age novel. Worst roommate ever. Blumhouse, the studio behind horror heart racers like Paranormal Activity, Insidious, and Purge movies, has mastered the true crime space with this Netflix docuseries, featuring a mix of on-camera interviews and stylized animated reenactments. That'll have you reconsidering who you live with. And our last item is a book, The Devils. There are a few moments in Joe Abercrombie's new novel where you half expect someone to say, "What are we? Some kind of suicide squad?" Only it's a not quite holy monk leading a magician, vampire, elf, werewolf, undead knight, and smart aleck navigator into dangerous territory. But the best-selling fantasy author has more than a few twists to shake things up. That's our must list for this week. Marvel's delightful Thunderbolts Asterisk, a Netflix true crime series, and The Rehearsal topped this week's list. It was by the Entertainment Weekly staff. So let's start off with that article about Freaky Friday. Raising the Freaky Flag, inside Jamie Lee Curtis and Lindsay Lohan's 22-year bond fueling freakier Friday's soul. Curtis, Lohan, and their freaky sequel family swap stories on returning for more body switching, new and old motherhood, and keeping nostalgia alive for a new generation. This is by Joey Nolfi. Nisha Ganatra has something on her phone you need to see. It's a sunny April afternoon in Los Angeles, and the film director eagerly holds her phone to show off a black and white snapshot. It's a candid behind-the-scenes vignette of Lindsay Lohan nestled in a comfortable slump on Jamie Lee Curtis's lap. The Oscar-winning Halloween franchise vet gently cradles her on-screen daughter between takes on set of Disney's Freakier Friday, the highly anticipated sequel to body-swapping family comedy Freaky Friday. It looked like a mother and daughter really holding each other, Ganatra recalls of capturing the shot, still fresh in her mind and heart, over a year after filming. That's something you can't bring as a director. They have a love and a trust. They bring a joyfulness out in each other, and that's gold. Curtis knows what you're thinking. This is just that weird thing when you're doing a movie promotion where the stars fake their fondness for each other. Not the case, she insists, speaking to Entertainment Weekly while sitting next to Lohan in a dressing room on set for a freakier marketing shoot. Their natural chemistry is as evident during the afternoon conversation as it is on screen in their long-awaited sequel, the product of 22 years of friendship. I've known Lindsay since she was 15, Curtis explains, of meeting Lohan while filming the 2003 film, which became a teen comedy hit to the tune of $110 million at the domestic box office. It's just an extraordinary thing to watch someone walk through life. The actresses' trajectories may have deviated slightly since their initial collaboration, but Lohan confirms she and Curtis remained an important part of each other's lives over the decades, and Freakier Friday's narrative celebrates that power of ties that endure and prevail through sometimes sorcerous hurdles. Written by Dollface creator and Sweethearts writer and director Jordan Weiss, Freakier Friday, in theaters August 8th, finds Tess, played by Curtis, and Anna, played by Lohan, in the days leading up to the latter's wedding to British restaurateur Eric, played by Manny Jacinto. Tess, now a successful podcaster and author, is still a helicopter parent, though her propellers now pull double duty as a mom and a doting grandma to Anna's 15-year-old daughter, Harper, played by Julia Butters. A wacky psychic, played by Vanessa Bayer, senses familial disarray and switches the duo's minds with that of Harper and Anna's soon-to-be stepchild, Lily, played by Sophia Hammonds. The blended tribe's soul-switching trials are all by design, of course. As in the 2003 film, the events are purposefully engineered by occult entities to test the bonds of blood. But this time, the ties that bind chosen family are challenged too, all while the teens at the center resist each other and their fate as stepsisters-to-be. Like their characters, Curtis and Lohan, who also produced their new film, have grown personally and professionally since last sharing the screen. Lohan, 38, is a new mom hot off a Hollywood comeback thanks to a three-picture Netflix deal, and she'll re-team with Disney on Hulu's just-announced series adaptation of suspense thriller novel Count My Lies. Curtis, 66, now has an Academy Award for her work in 2022's Everything Everywhere All at Once. But unlike Harper and Lily, they couldn't be happier to meet each other back in this moment, one they say the universe willed into existence with a little earthly help from Curtis. In every country I went to promote Halloween Ends, the only consistent question I got was, when are you making another Freaky Friday? I called you on the road at one point and said, "This is all people are asking," Curtis says, turning toward Loan. Clearly, there was an appetite for this. Enough so that Curtis launched a personal mission, taking the idea to those who mattered most, Disney boss Bob Iger and Loan, whom she phoned in late 2022 with a pitch while the Mean Girls star filmed her 2024 rom-com Irish Wish in Europe. When Jamie called me in Ireland, I was like, "Yes, I'm in. Let's do it." It's not very often that you get to work with someone who's been such a big part of your life on a personal level, Loan recalls, smiling as she stares back at the friend who made it happen. "That was exciting for me to come back and do a big screen film with a woman that I admire that's part of my life off screen. To have that chance again, it doesn't happen much. I felt lucky to be able to do it." Raising the freaky flag higher. While fate and fandom conspired to reunite Curtis and Loan, making a sequel to one of the millennial generation's most cherished comedies was a monumental task that required more than just the stars' desire to work together again. Their mystical movie star chemistry isn't the only thing fueling the film's appeal. Its script has a surprising amount of heart, progressing the stories of these beloved characters rather than simply retreading old ground for those who grew up with the prior installment and might now be watching with their own children. "It's the reason you go to the movies. It's the reason you go to a Disney movie," Curtis says of the film's buoyant climax, which, without spoiling too much, repositions Loan on a musical stage in soaring fashion. "To have a moment where all of a sudden you're going to reach over and hold the hand of the person sitting next to you, if it's your mom, grandma, friend, you're going to be moved by it." Yes, beloved characters return. Chad Michael Murray's hunky Jake, Mark Harmon's loving stepdad Ryan, and even Stephen Tobolowsky's Mr. Bates. Obvious references are made. Curtis outdoes her. "I'm like the Crypt Keeper" joke from the first film by a mile. And the themes are mostly the same. One thing you won't see, however, is a cameo from Jodie Foster, who starred in the first adaptation of Mary Rogers' Freaky Friday novel in 1976. "We begged her. She's not going to do it," says Ganatra. Entertainment Weekly has reached out to a representative for Foster for comment. And maybe that's for the best, because one of Freakier Friday's strengths, and what sets it apart from many family-oriented sequels, is that while it's a nostalgic jaunt into the past, it never hits those beats without earning them. Every moment is accounted for, Murray feels. When you get to walk on set and it just feels like it's home, why would you not want to be there? It felt like an all-encompassing, loving, great dynamic, like no time had passed. Yet we had entire lives in between. It's a very full film. Or as Loan puts it, Freakier Friday is a timeless story of dynamics within a family, exemplified in the film's opening sequence. The scene trains on Anna, a single mom dreaming of her past life as a rock star after giving up her successful stint as Pink Slip's guitarist and vocalist for a day job at a record label so she could raise Harper. Though her former bandmates, played by returning stars Christina Vidal and Haley Hudson, are still part of her life. Anna now fusses over her daughter's early morning grumbles, rushes to get her out the door, and even shouts, "Make good choices!" at the blurry teen from the car as she drops her off at school just as Tess did with her. Things have changed quite a bit for Tess and Anna, and it's all motivated by the actress's personal evolution. Particularly, Loan feels a stronger connection to the story after she and her husband, Bader Shamas, welcomed a son, Luai, in July 2023. The closeness that you have with your child and that bond, how irreplaceable that is, and wanting to do the right thing for your child, is always the most important thing in the world, and nothing can stand in the way of that, Loanne says of the perspective she has now, but couldn't bring to filming Freaky Friday at age 16. I also didn't have the calmness that a mother needs to have when a child is losing it. Now, I get to play with that. I get to have those moments that Tess used to have with Anna. Mother of the Lohannesance. During their interview, it's easy to see Loanne and Curtis's appreciation for each other. Curtis often breaks her gaze to cast gentle glances toward Loanne when she speaks, and her face lights up when she hears Loanne assert her priorities as a new mom. Everything I do is about what's going to work for my family, Loanne explains, of choosing projects at this stage of her career. If something works around that, it's meant to happen. If it doesn't work around that, it's a no-go. It's a marked difference from the hectic early 2000s Loanne spent on seemingly every movie poster and tabloid cover, until her Netflix deal that produced 2022's Falling for Christmas, Irish Wish, and Our Little Secret, also from 2024. Loanne hadn't led a feature distributed by a major Hollywood studio since 2007's I Know Who Killed Me. And the new mom knew she was ready for more. It's a manifestation, she says, of Freakier Friday, because I had this thing in my head during COVID. I was like, I want to work with Netflix and do a couple movies, but I want to work with Disney again, too. It came to fruition because I believed it. Those things are meant to happen. I love my life, and I'm grateful for these moments I have. Curtis says watching Loanne become a mother and a woman has been a great privilege, and even relates her own experience filming Freaky Friday to that of her on-screen daughters during production of the sequel. I had a 15-year-old and a 5-year-old at home, with 3 days of prep before the original Freaky Friday, Curtis reflects. If it filmed outside California, I wouldn't have been in the movie. If it shot in Vancouver, I wouldn't have done it because I had kids. Balancing motherhood is a big part of our lives, but it's also a big part of the movie. It's the story of the movie. That narrative expands in the sequel thanks to new cast and crew, whom Loanne and Curtis quickly adopted into their expanding, freaky family. Ginatra, who helmed Tracy Ellis Ross and Dakota Johnson's 2020 comedy The High Note, and Mindy Kaling and Emma Thompson's 2019 Sundance hit Late Night, joined the project in early 2024 after a series of meetings with Disney and producers. The filmmaker found the idea of directing Freakier Friday intimidating, but was confident she could lean into the emotional arc of it and push the studio to make it more moving. She was also eager to buck the trend of the anti-hero in Hollywood films made by men, which she says really bums me out as an audience member. As a gay person, I know a lot about chosen family. The idea struck me that there's the family you think you are and the family you could be. If you're afraid to let people in and grow, you're limiting yourself, she adds of the story, which showcases a modern, blended family navigating the universally relatable, quote-unquote, messy journey of parenthood. Things weren't always so serious on set, though. This is a Disney sequel, after all, and Ginatra's goal was a product that lifts you up in the end. And for her, one that ensures audiences aren't forgetting the movie by the time they get into their car. Table manners. In a mid-film plot by Harper as Anna, remember, daughter as mom, to meddle in her mother's affairs, she puts her feelings aside and partners with Lily as Tess, her soon-to-be stepdaughter as grandma. Phew. Together, the frenemies hatch a scheme that, for one reason or another, requires, quote-unquote, Anna to reintroduce herself to her dreamy motorcycle-riding ex-high school crush, Jake, who now owns a record store. In this sequence of comical seduction, Loanne feels free on screen in ways we haven't seen her in years, perhaps because of the comfortable familial vibe of the collaborators around her. soundtracked by Britney Spears, another nod to the prior film, an electric energy washes over her as the star climbs atop a table and writhes around in front of Murray. But as Curtis recalls, all that was written on the page was, "Anna flips her hair for Jake." None of that was there, Loewen confirms. "I almost fell off a few times. I think Chad's reactions were real." Murray agrees, "I loved watching Lindsay own it. It was like, oh, there she is." Ganatra thinks the performance will reposition Loewen in the eyes of the industry amid the ongoing Lohanissance. "I feel the people are going to see the Lindsay that has the twinkle in her eye, is a little mischievous, has a big effing heart, and makes you smile while watching her," she says. "It's not the nostalgia of, it's Anna again. It's Lindsay doing what we love watching Lindsay do." Freakies in the family. Loewen also found fans in the film's Next Gen stars, with 16-year-old Butters endearingly referring to her and Curtis as Friday's founding mothers. "As humans, they're so nurturing," adds Hammonds, 18, while seated next to Butters on break from the marketing shoot with Curtis and Loewen. "Putting that kind of person in a position to welcome two new actors into this story worked out great. I got a parental vibe from them. It felt like they always had our backs, always looking out for us." Ganatra says she aimed to amplify that intimacy with some weird rehearsal stuff during preparation, putting her stars through awkward encounters that honed their attention on the physical notes they'd need to hit to make those role reversals feel natural. "The whole movie falls apart if you don't believe it's real," Ganatra says. "So the four actresses rehearsed in a dance studio for weeks, practicing each other's mannerisms, studying vocal inflections, and engaging in what can be described as an emotional transference, spiritual osmosis, or a combination of the two. They held hands, stared into each other's eyes for great lengths, and exchanged secret notes written in character. They'd give us a scenario to play out, like your first mother-daughter bonding moment. You're going to come out, and Lindsay will tuck you in with a blanket. It built memories to use as a foundation for later," Butters shares. "One time, I got a migraine on set. There's not much you can do if it's not going away with medicine. Lindsay gave me sunglasses to wear during her coverage. I sat slouched in a corner and she'd squeeze my neck, fully unprompted," she continues. "Mother, literally. And Jamie really did act like Lindsay's mom on set," Hammonds recalls. "Then they started acting like that toward us. We're always getting kisses on the forehead or cheek. We slowly became part of that circle, too." Acceptance of their new brood means that, like most families, the quartet are now deeply embedded in an ongoing group text titled Freakies, where Butters and Hammonds say their on-screen maternal figures share bits of wisdom, updates on the film's progress, and messages of encouragement, while also organizing meetups and dinners and more. Hammonds emphasizes that she and Butters literally are best friends in real life because of the movie, while Butters, who says she and Hammonds are building our own 20-year friendship, makes a sweet promise to her bestie beside her, "Sorry, but you're stuck with me." Laughing, Hammonds compares the group's relationship to an imagined monument. "Freaky Friday Mountain," she calls it, but instead of Mount Rushmore, it's Lindsay and Jamie's faces chiseled into it, and maybe we'll be like little stones on that mountain. Picture-perfect Hollywood ending. Back in their dressing room, Curtis and Loewen are anything but etched in stone, marveling at how they both have evolved since their 2003 hit. The former's voice softens as she recalls discovering the hows and the whys surrounding the latter's permanent move to Dubai in 2014. She was looking to find a calm place and quiet that wasn't going to be in New York or L.A. because they're filled with aggro people. "It impressed me so much," says Curtis. I grew up so much in the public eye that I never really had the space to take time for me and just have a normal life, Loan explains. I found it there. A part of it might exist right here with Curtis, too. I understood the depth of the woman you've become. I give you great respect for that, Curtis says, her eyes still on Loan. I couldn't freaking do that at your age. I wouldn't have known how to do that. That speaks volumes to the woman she's become, the type of human she is, the type of mother, wife, friend. She hugs Loan, whose head finds its rightful place in the cradle of Curtis's neck. Then Loan smiles, unknowingly recreating a version of that photo Ganatra holds so dear as a reminder of the love that went into their freakier adventure. That was Raising the Freaky Flag, inside Jamie Curtis and Lindsay Loan's 22-year bond, fueling Freakier Friday's soul. It was by Joey Nolfi. And this is a good time to take a quick break to say that you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm reading from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. Next, we have a review of Thunderbolts Asterisk. Florence Pugh, Sebastian Stan, and the gang are mostly successful at keeping the Marvel torch lit. Between meals at fine restaurants, there are also gas station sandwiches, and they aren't so bad. This is by Jordan Hoffman. I am happy to report that by the end of Thunderbolts Asterisk, you will know why the title has an asterisk. No, I'm not going to spoil it here. But when that big reveal comes, it lands with more of an, oh, okay, than any sort of catharsis. That's the overall vibe to this latest entry in the never-ending parade of Marvel films and television series. Thunderbolts Asterisk serves two purposes. The good news is that it's further proof that Florence Pugh is a dynamic screen talent. She's funny, charismatic, sympathetic, and believable, in as much as anyone is, doing those slow-mo superhero twirls across a room filled with shattered glass. The less exciting news is that this movie feels like connective tissue in the enormous Marvel enterprise, something to keep the franchise motor running before Fantastic Four later this summer and a new Avengers movie next year. You know, the ones with superheroes everyone has heard of. At least the lesser tier element here is something the characters are aware of. I can't recall ever seeing a franchise film with this much self-criticism. Our leader, Pugh's Yelena Belova, has more than one moment of declaring, "We suck!" which is amusing, until it isn't. Unfortunately, the movie decides to follow the now played out trend of actually being about trauma, which was novel when The Babadook came out in 2014, but is now pretty much a punchline. So, who are the Thunderbolts? Well, they are a ragtag team of assassins with dark pasts who have all been in the employ of Valentina Allegra de Fontaine, played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, the head of the CIA, who is facing impeachment hearings. Her resume of nefarious deals and an association with the not-so-good OXE group have caught up with her. We know OXE is bad because they have a giant Iron Mountain-esque bunker out in the desert filled with materiel that needs to be disappeared before it gets Valentina in trouble. And among the things that need to be destroyed? Those aforementioned assassins who are lured into Valentina's high-tech vault. It's not just Yelena, whom you hopefully remember from Black Widow, but U.S. Agent John Walker, played by Wyatt Russell, a one-time Captain America who isn't quite as noble as Steve Rogers or Sam Wilson, Ghost, played by Hannah John Kamen, a gal who can pass through walls thanks to a weird phase-shifting suit, and Bob, played by Lewis Pullman, who has a kind of amnesia and seems, at first, just to be some dopey guy, but later reveals himself to be something else. The gang escapes Valentina's trap, but I need to warn you, it takes a strange amount of time for them to do so. I checked my watch about an hour into this movie with one thought on my mind. So, when is this movie actually going to start? Luckily, things pick up once everyone climbs back to the surface, and that's when our little band of morally gray heroes are joined by Yelena's father, the Red Guardian, played by David Harbour, and Bucky Barnes, played by Sebastian Stan, who did, in fact, win the election that was alluded to in Captain America: Brave New World, and is now serving Brooklyn in the House of Representatives. Valentina's looming impeachment pushes her into true villain mode, and that's when we learn about the Sentry Project. Without giving too much away, this is like a revived Captain America super serum thing, but a thousand times more powerful. Naturally, this blows up in her face and unleashes a terrible threat into the world. In a nice nod to the first Avengers film, our heroes must face a nasty villain right outside Grand Central Terminal, the spot where Earth's mightiest heroes once battled the invading Chitauri aliens. However, this time they are not fighting beasts from a distant star, but the abstract concept of gloom, depression, and the pull of the void. This is manifested as a creeping darkness that turns innocent New Yorkers into shadows, which is a rather effective visual. Some gasped in the audience. To combat this threat, our team members, particularly Yelena, must also face the painful memories of the past. This means flopping through different symbolic rooms of an imaginary house, a shtick that Danielle Deadwyler also had to do for the same reason in The Woman in the Yard, a movie that might still be playing when Thunderbolts Asterisk hits the Cineplex. A lot of what works in the movie does so due to the talent of the performers. There aren't a lot of jokes or killer lines in this, but little bits of business that Pugh and Russell in particular make work. Harbour's loud, boorish Russian bear is funny at first, but alas, gets tiresome in a short amount of time. Put bluntly, some scenes come together nicely, but many others don't. The fights are just okay. Harbour and Pugh barking at one another about clinical depression with over-the-top, must-catch-moose-and-squirrel accents is a true WTF moment. The good news is that things end up on an up note, so you'll walk out of the theater with some pep. As far as being a nice lead-in to Fantastic Four: First Steps is concerned, it's fair to call this a success. But if for some reason you missed this before July, it won't leave any lasting trauma. That was Thunderbolts Asterisk Review. Florence Pugh, Sebastian Stan, and the gang are mostly successful at keeping the Marvel torch lit. It was by Jordan Hoffman, who's giving the movie a grade of B. Here's one of their top stories. Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock gearing up for Speed reunion in new romantic thriller. The duo also starred together in 2006's The Lake House. This is by Wesley Stenzel. Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock are buckling in for another ride together. The former Speed co-stars are attached to an untitled new romantic thriller at Amazon MGM Studios, a representative for the studio confirmed to Entertainment Weekly. Described as a propulsive project, the film will be written by Noah Oppenheim, who we know from Jackie and The Maze Runner, and will reunite the two actors with Speed producer Mark Gordon, who also produced hits like Saving Private Ryan and The Patriot. Bullock, Reeves, Oppenheim, Bibi Dunn, and Sarah Brammer are also among the film's producers. Released in 1994, Speed earned around $350 million at the global box office on a $30 million budget. The film solidified Reeves' reputation as an action star following 1991's Point Break and helped break Bullock into the mainstream after several smaller projects. Speed marked the directorial debut of Jan de Bont, who previously worked as a cinematographer on films like Die Hard, which made him a fitting choice for the project, as the high-velocity bus thriller has often been colloquially known as Die Hard on a Bus. Reeves and Bullock teamed up again in 2006's The Lake House, a remake of a South Korean romantic fantasy drama. However, the two stars barely interact on screen in that film due to the story's central conceit. Two residents of the same house communicate across time periods using a magic mailbox. Bullock reprised her Speed role in the critically maligned 1997 sequel Speed 2 Cruise Control. Reeves did not join her in the project, though de Bont returned to the director's chair. Reeves and Bullock jokingly pitched a concept for Speed 3 during an anniversary screening at Beyond Fest in Los Angeles last year. The geriatric version, it won't be fast, the actress suggested. Reeves added, retirement. Bullock noted that she couldn't imagine making another Speed movie without de Bont, who was also present at the screening, and said that the filmmaker's more subdued demeanor might make helming another action-packed thriller difficult. All these things happened because the crazy man in the greenish jacket over there, the While You Were Sleeping star said, referring to the filmmaker. He's so soft and gentle today, and I'm like, that's not the man I remember. But he's the man who put the energy and the idea together and knew what the audience wanted and demanded it from everyone, and everyone stepped up to the plate. Bullock also said that another Speed would require a lot from everybody, and speculated that the contemporary film industry might not be willing to tolerate it and be brave enough to do it. Reeves currently has a number of new projects in the works, including a fifth John Wick movie and Aziz Ansari's comedy Good Fortune. Bullock has less on her upcoming slate, but is expected to return for the long-awaited Practical Magic sequel alongside her co-star from the original film, Nicole Kidman. That was Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock gearing up for Speed reunion in new romantic thriller. It was by Wesley Stenzel. Here is an EW exclusive. Damson Idris says he felt absolute fear before F1 test drive audition. It was insane. It was really a test of maturity, humility, and patience, says the actor, who stars in the film opposite Brad Pitt. This is by Maureen Lee Lanker. Writer-director Joseph Kosinski redefined the need for speed with 2022's Top Gun Maverick, and he's ready to do it again, only this time on the racetrack. The filmmaker is the mind behind this summer's F1 out June 27th, a movie that takes audiences inside the world of Formula One racing and puts them up close and personal with the sport and its drivers, who, as it turns out, have a fair amount in common with fighter pilots. They are the rock stars of their own universe, Kosinski says, and obviously both have a need for speed. But when it came to actually making the film, there were very few similarities to Kosinski's 2022 hit. On Top Gun, we were off on an aircraft carrier 100 miles off the coast, the director explains. This movie we shot in front of an audience of 400,000 people. Often I had only a few minutes to shoot a scene because we were actually shooting it at the real live event. There was a stage play-esque vibe to this, where we had to be very well prepared, but execute in the moment and only get a few takes at a scene. Yet it was Top Gun that inadvertently led to F1 in a roundabout way, as Kosinski first met F1 superstar Lewis Hamilton when they discussed the driver's potential involvement with Maverick. Then, during the COVID-19 lockdown, Kosinski got hooked on the Netflix docuseries Drive to Survive, which follows teams over the course of the Formula One season. I was fascinated by this notion that your teammate can be your biggest enemy, the director says. Everyone's always comparing who's faster. To me, that seems very ripe for drama. So I dropped Lewis an email and said, "Hey, I'd love to make a movie in this world. Would you be interested in helping me?" And he said he would. Now, 4 years later, that movie is ready to start its proverbial engine. F1 stars Brad Pitt as Sonny Hayes, a former driver who retired after a horrible crash. But old friend and former teammate Ruben Cervantes, played by Javier Bardem, approaches Sonny with a tantalizing proposition. Come out of retirement and help coach this rookie prodigy, Josh Noah Pierce, played by Damson Idris. The casting and narrative offer a fitting metaphor, given that Idris is a promising newcomer on screen himself. Audiences will know him best from 6 seasons of FX's Snowfall, and Pitt is a longtime movie star. Kaczynski already knew Pitt and wanted an icon for the role. He felt the actor was the perfect choice. Idris, on the other hand, landed the part after a series of auditions that culminated with the ultimate test, getting behind the wheel for real. The actor, 33, says he's been a fan of F1 for a long time and attended his first race in 2018, but he never considered actually driving in one. "The feeling I felt before was absolute fear," the actor confesses, "but at the end of it, driving up to 180 miles per hour, going from track to track around the world is an opportunity that I could never have dreamed of." It was crucial to Kaczynski that his lead actors be able to do all their own driving. After reading scenes, "We actually put him in a race car out at a track just north of London," the director says. "We spent a day testing his skills to make sure he had enough there that we could develop it into something." For Idris, it was a true test of his nerves thanks to some characteristically British weather. "It was insane," he says. "The universe decided to rain that day. I went to Bedford Autodrome and jumped in an F3000 and they attached cameras to the car. It was really a test of maturity, humility, and patience." From there, Idris spent 7 months in intense training behind the wheel. "You start to go to sleep and dream of the corners," he says. "You just build a real confidence due to the time and repetition going around the track." Though Idris never had a problem with the fast speeds, getting the car started was the true challenge. "I was really good at driving at crazy speeds," the actor says. "I was really good at driving around the track and doing all the crazy turns. The hardest thing for me was actually getting a car started. The clutch is a hand clutch." Idris adds, "Brad was just exquisite at it, but man, there was some sort of coordination that was just not clicking with me. Once I got it started, I was ready to fly." And it turns out driving as fast as you can isn't just fun, it's safer. Idris says the best thing the head stunt driver told him was that the slower you drive, the worse it actually is for the car. The car starts to break down because you're not getting enough heat into the tires. The actor's preparation behind the wheel was the first step toward making something that felt electric and alive. But the other essential piece was getting the Formula One racing community to support and appear in the film. "We had a scene where every single team came out with all their mechanics, and they pretended like everyone was repairing their cars on the pit while we were shooting," Kaczynski explains. "We shot at every race. We had a garage on the pit lane next to their garages. We would not have been able to make this movie without them. It certainly wouldn't look the way it does without their participation." But that also made the filmmakers and the actors' groundwork even more critical. "We would often have 5 to 10 minutes, a very, very short window to shoot a scene," Kaczynski says. "Only getting 2 or 3 takes is something we're not used to, It was more like live performance, and we had to get it right. He adds, I was amazed at how few mistakes people made when it really counted. It's like something your brain dials in and tells you you have to get it right. So you do. In addition to immersing the audience in the real races and locations of Formula One, the need to move quickly under pressure ultimately heightened the film's stakes. You feel it in the performances, Kaczynski notes. There's an energy and an adrenaline pumping through when shooting in a real situation that, hopefully, I was able to capture. That realism extended to the drivers playing themselves in the film, both in dialogue scenes and driving in action scenes. Kaczynski shot a podium sequence for the film at the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix minutes after the actual medal podium was presented. But even though Kaczynski found the driver's support invaluable, it didn't mean Idris and Pitt were out there befriending them. I purposefully didn't become friends with them because I wanted to have the mentality that they are my competition, Idris explains. Still, that didn't stop him from asking for advice in critical moments. We're doing the national anthem at Silverstone racetrack, and I turned to the right and I was like, hey man, during the national anthem, do you zip the suit up or do you zip the suit down? Brad and I had ours up and everybody else had theirs down. Idris also credits Hamilton and his presence on set with helping him shape his character. He'd always come to set with such energy, the actor says. I'm completely indebted to him for teaching me the mindset of a rookie and how insane this sport is and how much focus it takes. Both Idris and Kaczynski hope the film will inspire legions of new fans and showcase the wide variety of roles within the world of F1. The film's not just about the drivers, the actor says. It's about all the people behind the scenes who make the car run, the engineers, the pit crew. You get to see a little bit of how the full team works. Even if you don't know Formula One from NASCAR, don't worry. We had to make a film that worked for the F1 aficionado and, at the same time, played to someone who didn't know anything about racing, Kaczynski concludes. Serving those two gods at the same time has been a really unique challenge, but Formula One hasn't nearly tapped its potential in the United States, and it'd be great to convert more people. In short, Kaczynski hopes F1 will give a new audience the green flag to get into the sport. That was Damson Idris says he felt absolute fear before F1 test drive audition. It was insane. It's only available on Entertainment Weekly, and it was by Maureen Lee Linker. And I have two stories about people returning for sequels. The first one, Isla Fisher reappears with the Four Horsemen in first Now You See Me, Now You Don't trailer. Jesse Eisenberg, Mark Ruffalo, Woody Harrelson, Dave Franco, and Morgan Freeman all also return to star in the third magical heist movie. This is by Sydney Buxbaum. Isla Fisher just pulled off the most impressive magic trick. After 12 years, she's reappeared in the Now You See Me franchise. The first Now You See Me, Now You Don't trailer reunites Fisher with the rest of the original Four Horsemen, Jesse Eisenberg, Woody Harrelson, and Dave Franco, after she sat out of the magic heist sequel, Now You See Me 2. The third movie in the franchise, directed by Ruben Fleischer, known for Zombieland and Uncharted, also brings back Mark Ruffalo and Morgan Freeman, and introduces new cast members Rosamund Pike, Ariana Greenblatt, Dominic Sessa, and Justice Smith. In the trailer that's linked in the article, Eisenberg's J. Daniel Atlas meets with a team of young magicians, that's Greenblatt, Sessa, and Smith, to recruit them for a trick bigger and better than anything you've ever seen. His old team? They're dead to him, he says. The new team of four set out to steal a valuable heart diamond from a wealthy, corrupt family, but of course they need backup. Franco, Harrelson, and Fisher pop up to help, and they all join forces with Freeman. Now You See Me began in 2013 with the first movie centered on the foursome of criminals who use their elaborate stage illusions to pull off major heists and, in true Robin Hood fashion, give the stolen money to people who need it. Directed by Louis Leterrier, that film introduced Ruffalo's FBI agent Dylan Rhodes, who pretended to be hunting the Four Horsemen, but was actually their mysterious benefactor and mastermind the entire time. Freeman starred as Thaddeus Bradley, a former magician who profited by outing other magicians' tricks. Dylan used the Four Horsemen to get his revenge on Thaddeus for ruining his late father's career and ultimately causing his death. By the end of the first movie, the horsemen were welcomed into the mysterious magician society, the Eye. The second installment, 2016's Now You See Me 2, was directed by John M. Chu, picked up 18 months after the events of the first film. Fisher did not return, and Lizzie Kaplan was cast as a new member of the Four Horsemen in her absence. The magicians were now fugitives after escaping the FBI and dealt with the consequences of stealing from Arthur Tressler, played by Michael Caine, in the first movie. As his son Walter, played by Daniel Radcliffe, exposed their illusions, working with Merritt's, that's Harrelson's, twin brother. The second movie also featured a major twist when Dylan and the horsemen learned that the imprisoned Thaddeus is actually the leader of the Eye, and that he had only pretended to be Dylan's father's rival. Thaddeus then chose Dylan to be his successor as the leader of the Eye. Now You See Me, Now You Don't magically reappears in theaters November 14th. That was Isla Fisher reappears with the Four Horsemen in first Now You See Me, Now You Don't trailer. It was by Sydney Buxbaum, and that trailer is linked in the article. And the last article I have is The Accountant 2 director teases Anna Kendrick's return for a third film. She wants to do it. Filmmaker Gavin O'Connor says the Ben Affleck-led action series was always meant to be three movies. This is by Mike Miller. It's not as certain as Death and Taxes, but it seems like a third Accountant film is coming due. Nearly a decade after the sleeper hit first installment debuted, Ben Affleck and John Bernthal have reteamed with director Gavin O'Connor for The Accountant 2. Affleck returns as Christian Wolf, a high-functioning autistic black market accountant who uses his neurodivergency to crack complex puzzles and take down crime kingpins between filing tax returns. Bernthal plays his formerly estranged brother, Brax, a clingy hitman with a short fuse. Noticeably absent from the sequel is Anna Kendrick's Dana Cummings, an accountant Wolf helps and eventually develops feelings for in the first film. While her character is never mentioned in the follow-up, O'Connor says we might not have seen the last of her or the Wolf brothers. We always wanted it to be three movies, O'Connor tells Entertainment Weekly. When screenwriter Bill Dubuque and I started talking about the second movie, it was very important that we didn't want a love story. We wanted a love story with brothers. We wanted to do a 48 Hours or Midnight Run kind of buddy picture. O'Connor points out that in the first film, Braxton and Christian don't even meet each other until the third act, and it's violent. With the sequel, the director says he wanted to explore their relationship and let them try to fix their stuff, adding, I knew there were opportunities for comedy to be mined out there and also for emotion to be mined out there. So that was very intentional. He continues, then the third movie, which is what the plan has always been, is for Chris's quest for love and connection to be consummated. I don't know what that's going to be yet, but that's the intention. As for why Kendrick's Cummings doesn't appear in the sequel, O'Connor says there just wasn't room enough for her story. Yeah, I mean, how do I bring Anna into this second and then ignore her, he says. The whole point was exploring the brothers and that emotional line between them. That was always the intention, so she was never going to be in the second. But once he and Dubuque come up with a plan for the third film, O'Connor says the actress is ready to return. We've had conversations. She wants to do it. We just have to figure out how to do it, he says. Still, that might take some time. While there were a number of reasons it took nearly 10 years to make the sequel, including a pandemic, industry strikes, and studio shakeups, O'Connor notes that it's not so easy coming up with puzzles that only Wolf can solve. I gotta be honest, I am so tired of these Byzantine puzzle plots, the director says with a laugh. It's really hard to do. If it's an easy plot, you don't need Christian. While the story can't be so confounding that the audience checks out, the filmmaker says, it needs to be complicated enough to justify Wolf's brain power. Or maybe O'Connor will go a completely different direction next time. I think I may just do a road picture or something, refresh just as much as we refreshed the tank on the second movie. At the end of the day, the director says, I'm going to probably do something that makes me interested to come to work every day and tell a story. And then, lastly, yes, if it's going to be Anna, Chris needs to find love and connection and go off into the sunset. So it probably will be with Dana Cummings. That was The Accountant 2 director teases Anna Kendrick's return for a third film. She wants to do it. And it was by Mike Miller. That is all the time we have for Entertainment Weekly this week. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you for listening this week. Please come back next week and we'll take a look at what EW.com has for us. Until then, goodbye.